How kind are you to your romantic partner? How kind are you to yourself? Welcome to this episode of Sex, Love, and Elephants. I've got something special for y'all today. This is a talk I gave just a couple of months ago at a three-day self-compassion meditation and Buddhism retreat I taught in December. And this is the first of three talks I gave in the evening. And the themes you're going to hear today are profoundly helpful for each of us in our incredibly busy lives. Our high stress, high activity lives where we can lose sight of the thing that matters the most, which is compassion for ourselves, compassion for others, compassion for our partner, our family, our friends, and strangers. So I hope you'll really enjoy this really quite deep and wide-ranging conversation or talk I gave. You'll hear some of the students in the background the odd time at a meditation retreat on the topic of self-compassion. How can we be with things as they are? How can we be kind to ourselves? And why do we keep chasing the wrong things that we think will make us happy when happiness is right here, right now? Hope you enjoy. For the sake of all beings, wisdom, compassion, and non-clinging awareness. So this will be the first talk in this three-day retreat. The themes of this retreat are multivariate, actually, but some of the themes are practicing mindfulness and some loving kindness practices, and then contemplating what it is to be a really very good and loving friend. And how and who we are when we're being a very good and loving friend. And then we'll be exploring a little later in this retreat, how do we be a good and loving friend to ourselves? We're often far less kind, far less forgiving in a healthy way, far less compassionate to ourselves. But I want to sketch a bit of a bigger picture first. So I'm sure when we were children, many of us had an idea of who or what we wanted to be when we grew up. I don't know yet because I haven't yet grown up, but I've at various times wanted to be a famous horse rider. I wanted to be an actor. For a brief, ridiculous point of time, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I got disabused of that notion pretty quickly, and so on. And when you ask kids, I'm not so sure about today. Maybe some of you teach young children, and maybe you can speak to this if you ask kids today what they want to be when they grow up. I don't know if it's similar or different, but in my day, it might have been a fireman, because it wasn't called firefighter back then. It might have been a pilot. When I was in Africa, we went to a village of children whose parents had died during the AIDS and HIV epidemic, and I was supporting a couple of the kids there and supporting that wonderful organization. And these beautiful, bright kids that were part of a choir that would travel around, many of you may have seen them, they come to the island quite often, the Watoto African choir from Uganda, and these kids would march up and introduce themselves, 6 years old to 16 years old. I want to be a pilot. I want to be a teacher. I want to be a pastor. It's wonderful. And in North America, kids want to be what they want to be, and maybe you'll cringe a little bit when they say they want to be an Instagram influencer, whatever that is. I don't even have an Instagram account. But or they want to be, you know, a musician. None of these are bad things, but when do you hear a child say, I want to be happy? Wouldn't that be something if we ask kids or big kids like us, you know, what do you really want? I want to be happy. I want to be happy. And maybe being a pilot, a pastor, a teacher, a lawyer, XYZ, can be one small significant aspect of happiness. I'm not saying it's not. But we're so far away from our automatic thoughts, feelings being articulated as what I want is to be happy, content, free from suffering is the language we'd use in Buddha Dharma. So I wanted to put that out there for a bit of a scratch on the head. of where our priorities are. And I'll put forward, perhaps so you can forgive yourself as well, that I believe the majority, if not all of our priorities, are in the realm of we'd like to be happy. But we're so deluded about how to get it, how to uncover it, how to be in a state of grace, in a state of happiness, that we believe getting that right job or career or lots and lots of money or are the answer. And even though I don't think anybody in this room or anyone anywhere really that takes a hard look at this really believes that that will lead to lifelong happiness, we still act as though it will most of the time. Most of the time, that if I only do this, get this, become this, experience this, am loved this way, live in this place, then everything will be okay. And again, we're not idiots. We know as we look at that with our intellectual mind that we know, okay, even if I get a beautiful house with a view, and even if I get a warm and loving partner, and even if I like my work, that doesn't mean I'll be happy all the time. So we know that's not the answer. But so much of our behavior and choices are still scattergunning towards getting the thing, getting the thing, getting the thing. So I wanted to lay that out. It's really the root of the Four Noble Truths of Buddha Dharma, is that we're chasing the wrong objects. We're chasing the wrong answers, really, to the question of how can one be happy, free from suffering, filled with grace, loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. So, if you have small or medium people or large or old people around you, maybe say, that's a wonderful goal. Why would you like to be a pilot? Oh, that's wonderful. What a noble profession. What a brave and wonderful profession. You can do so much good. But I hope you also want to be very happy when you grow up. I hope you also want to be calm when you grow up. I hope you want to be able to handle the tough things that will come your way when you grow up. So where does happiness come from? According to the advertising industry, it comes from things like having shiny white teeth or the right car or dining at the right restaurant with the right quality of people who all look joyously happy. Have you ever seen a restaurant advertisement where people look miserable? In fact, now you can have some homework for after retreat. If you ever watch network TV or something that actually has commercials on it, watch a few of the commercials. See what's depicted about how to be happy. Holy, it's going to blow your mind. Pick anything you can think of. Dental cream. I don't know. Tampons. Anything you can think of. A trip to Fiji. And there'll be an ad saying, if you only have that, everything's going to be fine. You'll be happy. And it doesn't mean you literally believe it. But what is it like when our minds are bombarded? Bombarded with messaging from every media source, from our family, from our friends, from our culture, from everything you hear and see, that just get this, your life will be better, a little bit more of this, and you'll be happier. Do you think it didn't affect you? It's so deeply sunk in, even if we don't intellectually believe it with our executive function up here, that if only that, then this. If only that, happier. If only that, more beautiful. And if more beautiful, more happy, right? Yeah, right. I used to be an actor, and I was doing an intensive acting program. I don't remember which one or where. And there was a fellow who was working with us in that field, and he was, I think, a photographer or something. And so he'd been photographing in some big city, a place where a lot of incredibly beautiful models were there. I think it was actually a fashion show. I don't remember all the details very well, but what I remember poignantly is him telling us how he was seeing these objectively in the cultural standards of what's considered just unbelievable physical beauty. That the woman he thought was the most beautiful was sobbing, sobbing, sobbing in the corner because she thought she was so ugly and so worthless. Now, the idea of a cultural idea of a cultural beauty aside, which isn't the point of that story, the point is even people who have the thing that we think so desirable aren't necessarily happy. Witness the drug addiction, suicides, divorces, chaos of so many rock stars and television stars and movie stars. Not trying to be a downer, just pointing out the abjectly obvious evidence that getting the things that are according to our culture, going to make us happy doesn't do the trick. Unless you're happy. If you're happy in your heart mind, then you can be beautiful or objectively ugly, which is just a dumb, stupid thing to say. But anyway, not my values. You can be rich or poor. You can be famous or unknown. And you're happy because happiness truly is an inside job. If you don't believe me, that's absolutely fine. But start doing your own research on yourself. When are you the most happy? Now, sometimes it's because the circumstances are really good. We've all been there where I was so happy for that few months that I was falling in love with this wonderful person. And maybe he's now your partner still, but you might not feel quite as excited about it as you did in the first 3 months. Or I was really happy those 2 years I was training in XYZ job or education, and I had good roommates and an interesting, stimulating life. But you know you weren't happy every day of the 2 years because you're not foolish. But sure, there's times we can think in our life, I was really happy, and it seems that it was mostly due to some really great circumstances and how happy I was within them. I'm not denying that. But really, really, when you were happy, it was also partly internal. When it was primarily external, if and when the external changed, your happiness changed. If it was the falling in love or the wonderful stimulating education and great roommates in a neat city, enjoying your life in college or postgrad or whatever, when that changed, the happiness didn't necessarily go with you. So listen to how fragile that is. This should actually freak you out. I hope it does. Listen to how fragile happiness is when it's dependent on something outside ourselves. Because what happens to things outside ourselves, they can go away in a moment's notice. Your loved one can be killed in a car accident any moment. I very much hope they're not. So as you examine this in yourself, think of times you're happy. Notice times you're happy. I felt very happy through that meditation. I haven't sat with you all or a group of people in a little while, and the mind was very happy. There were some thoughts and whatnot, but they were kind of in the background. And there was a sense of gentle, grounded happiness, contentedness. And it's not due to the external circumstances, although they're lovely. So want to delay those out. How often do we want to be happy when we grow up? How confused or clear are we on things, cause and effect? It's called karma in Buddha Dharma as well. But the cause and effect of happiness, if the cause is shiny new car means I'm happy, which may be true for a period of time. Shiny new cars can be really pleasant and beautiful and fun to drive. They're not a bad thing. But what happens a day later when it gets dented in the parking lot, or 6 months later when you've been driving it a lot and you just kind of don't notice that it's fun anymore because you got used to it? So most of you know this at least conceptually, but I want you to really start looking for it in your life. Like if breakfast tomorrow has your favorite foods, you'll be happy. What if it has your least favorite foods, or worse yet, foods you're allergic to or can't eat, or worse yet, foods you're allergic to and can't eat, and you very clearly ascertained that the kitchen knew and they swore that there'd be foods you could eat and that you did like and there aren't, right? It keeps going and going. Where does the happiness stop? Instead of, oh, I guess I'll have tea for breakfast. Might be a little hungry. None of us are going to die of starvation between breakfast and lunch tomorrow. There's a lot of people in the world for whom that statement is probably very, very true right now. So happiness is an inside job, which is what we're on about this weekend, is working with the inside, working with the mind and the heart and the emotions. So I'd like to speak now a little bit about emotions. There's not a word for emotions in Buddha Dharma. Did you know that? In Pali or Sanskrit, there are words that approximate what we would call emotions. There's the word kleshas, which are clingings or conglomerations, the poisons, the hetu, the roots of the poisons, which are greed, hatred, and delusion. Many of you have heard of those. But there isn't a word for what we in the West think of as an emotion. I'm sad. I'm angry. I'm blissed out. I'm jealous. I'm really content. We tend to ascribe a concrete meaning to these things. in the West. And if you don't know, I'm a psychologist by training. I'm not at all put off by emotional states. They're fascinating. They're challenging. They can be pulverizingly awful or gloriously good. But think of it slightly differently. We tend to think about emotion, and I used that language deliberately a few minutes ago. I'm angry, right? I'm sad. We tend to concretize it, that it is a real thing that we are, although we're probably pretty aware and believe and know that it's temporary. Like, I'm angry now, and then your cat does something ridiculously adorable, and you chuckle, and the anger isn't experienced for a bit. Oh, I'm not angry right now. But now I remember the thing I'm angry about. Now I'm back to being angry. But we tend to identify with our emotions, right? It's partly why I said that not particularly skillful critique of that book is, if you don't know the book, the person goes through a kind of regularly awful divorce, not particularly worse than divorces are, like yucky. But there's so much pain and so much agony and so much, you know, as though this has only ever happened to them. And they're so identified to all this pain and suffering that then they go off to eat, pray, and love, which were probably good choices, especially the pray one, because it was about, you know, maybe working on the internal state. Bravo. Then there's the love one. She finds the love of her life. They split up a few years ago, by the way, which is fine and beautiful. No judgment. I'm divorced. Whatever. It's not what I meant. But, you know, that there it is. The love is the answer. It's eat, pray, love. Love was the ultimate end of the book. Found the wonderful, extraordinary man who seems to be wonderful and extraordinary. Their parting was quite wonderful and extraordinary if you know anything about it. It doesn't matter if you don't. But these are outside things to make me happy. The pray part in the book, in that case, was to do with a type of, a Hindu meditation retreat. Doesn't matter. The pray part for us, don't care what word you use, is working on the inner mind. Stillness, finding the ability to be happy without objects, without good things making me happy, without good circumstances supporting me to be happy. Without the external. Let me be really clear, especially if you haven't heard this type of teaching in a while or at all. I am by no means saying that comfortable, wonderful lives are bad. They're absolutely not. And I wish and hope that all of us cultivate healthy homes, environments, work relationships, communities, and etc. The bad, and there's no word really for bad in Buddha Dharma either, which is awesome. The words are wholesome and unwholesome. So wholesome leads away from suffering. Let me repeat that. Wholesome leads away from suffering. So you can guess, unwholesome, ... leads towards suffering. So your home, your relationships, your work are wholesome if they lead away from suffering. But they're unwholesome if they lead towards suffering. So for example, I made a bit of a tongue-in-cheek quip there that for a while in about the third year of university, I thought, or the first year of university, I was thinking about maybe going into law, mainly because I'd been an actor in the play 12 Angry Men, or we retitled it 12 Angry Jurors because there were women and men in it. Kind of classic play. It was turned into a movie. Henry Fonda plays the guy who is the one juror of 12 who believes the young black man accused of murder is probably innocent. And the play is about him gradually bringing facts forward that convince the other 11 jurors to change their minds based on their own biases, racism, etc. And I played that role. So I thought law was going to be like that. I thought I would stand up on the right of justice and purity and fight against confusion and delusion and sway 11 people to see the truth. And in fact, in the play, that the young man accused of murder is not guilty, and they find him not guilty. So I thought I might want to be a lawyer because I want to fight for social justice and against injustice and to help represent people who maybe can't represent themselves. And then I decided there were other ways I would like to do that. But if I had gone into law, being a lawyer wouldn't have made me happy. Maybe it would have, like maybe I would have loved my career. But what I mean is that's not the source of happiness. My own chosen careers at this point, as a psychologist, and I run an online business for couples, and I do all sorts of things. I do many things. And I really enjoy most of those things, but I know they're not the source of my happiness. This is. You've all in your life many, many times And it would be useful homework during this retreat to contemplate this, maybe do a little bit of writing about it. When are times when circumstances have been really good in my life, wholesome, and I've been unhappy in here? And then the next question, what are times in my life, circumstances have been challenging, difficult, or worse, and I've been pretty good in here? You'll find both. And some of you have heard this story, but I'll tell it very briefly, sort of a contrast to being in an incredible environment and I was mentally very unhappy, and being in a really challenging, yucky environment and being very happy. So one was 12, 13 years ago, I was in Hawaii, the big island of Hawaii on the north end, with a dear friend who was a travel writer, and we were on the, you know, idyllic paradise beach with the palm trees and the perfect amount of shade and the crashing waves and turtles. There were all sorts of giant turtles coming in, and I don't think at that point I'd seen giant turtles ever, and it was so beautiful. It was literally a paradise postcard. And I was really, really unhappy, anxious, and miserable. I was in some difficulty with that friend and not clicking, and I was really upset and having all sorts of internal challenges about it. And I had the wherewithal to actually metaphorically step outside myself and say, holy smokes, look at you. You're on this amazing paradise beach in these incredible circumstances, and you're miserable. Huh. So that's one snapshot from the life of Cheryl. The next one would have been a decade before that, and it was in India. And after I finished my postdoc work, I went backpacking in Thailand and Nepal and India for about 7 or 8 months on the cheap, mainly attending Dharma retreats and studying with teachers and exploring and going to sacred sites like where the Buddha first gave his first discourse on the Four Noble Truths in the Deer Park, and meeting other Dharma bums, as we're called, and it was quite wonderful. And the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, was going to be teaching in Bodhanath, which is the place in the province of Bihar in India where the historical Shakyamuni Buddha is said to have become enlightened under the Bodhi tree. They have a sapling, a snippet, I'm not a gardener, but a piece of the original Bodhi tree, apparently, that they've regrown there. And there's a giant Bodhi tree with, of course, a temple all around it. And almost every, maybe every, I'm not sure, Buddhist sect or Buddhist flavor or Buddhist tradition has a temple around here. So the Dalai Lama teaches there, or used to teach there, I think once a year, mainly to Tibetans who would come from all over India. It's not that easy to come from Tibet to hear him, but Westerners were also allowed to come, and it was translated into English. So this was one of my main goals on this journey, was to go hear His Holiness teach. I think that was the second time I'd seen him teach for a night in San Francisco once. So I took a train, a rather dreadful 24-hour train, quite, you know, challenging circumstances, geese and ducks and cows and people and poo and TB and all sorts of stuff, challenging train ride. Many of you have traveled, you know what I'm talking about. And I get to Bodh Gaya and didn't think to book ahead. And a few other people were there, so there was nowhere to stay, just nowhere to stay. And I was with a French woman. I'm afraid I can't remember her name, but she had red hair and she was delightful. We'd met and she'd said, oh, I want to do that too. So we'd traveled down on the train together. And so we're kind of wandering around the streets with our backpacks. There's nowhere to stay. That is way before cell phones and it got so dang easy. I mean, it's the Lonely Planet guide. You're like flipping through, trying to find hostels. The Lonely Planet book is 2 years out of date. Most of the hostels don't exist anymore. And you're going randomly to these places and trying to get in. And so we're walking down the street and it's getting dark. We're like, ooh, where the heck are we going to sleep tonight? And a fellow came running out of his small house and said, you know, hi, I have a room. I have a room. We said, great, we'll take it. So he showed us to a room and it was pretty grim. Two little bunks, quite close to the floor, quite gross, quite a filthy bathroom, and we were delighted. We're like, great, thank you. We have a place to lay our head tonight. And so we did, and we slept, got up in the morning. And if any of you have been backpackers, used to be the way, maybe still is, don't know, you'd take a sleep sheet with you, which basically meant you got a sheet, right? And you went to your mom, in my case, because I can't sew, said, Mom, could you sew this up to make it like a sheet sleeping bag? Because when you went and stayed in all these hostels, some of them were a wee bit grubby, and you'd have your clean sheet to slip into, and then you could put the grubby blankets on top. It was perfect. So I'm in my sleep sheet, get up the next morning, go to shake out my my sheet, and oh, there's a bunch of rat poo inside of the sheet, sleeping bag sheet. So clearly, rats had come in, gone inside my little sleeping bag sheet, and had a nice little sleep next to me because I was warm and toasty. And it was raining really, really hard that night. And I mean, the walls didn't meet the floor. There was a gap. So as I like to quip, I may have slept with a few rats in my life, but those ones had 2 feet. So there you go. That was pretty gross. I wasn't at all upset. I was like, that's a trip. I guess I slept with some rats last night. Any bites? Nope. All right, carry on. In the hovel, with the rats, in the pouring rain, happy. Paradise, Hawaii, idyllic, tortoises, miserable. Your circumstances don't determine your happiness. Your circumstances don't determine your state of mind. You know what determines your state of mind? Your state of mind. I was so happy to be there. I was going to hear the Dalai Lama speak. And many of you know the other person who was there because you've heard this story. Richard Gere was also there. And Richard Gere is my Hollywood crush from when I was a kid. And there was a movie called Officer and a Gentleman. Some of you remember. And I think he is the most handsome man in the whole world. And he was there, so it just got better. I had His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Richard Gere's on stage next to him. Who do I look at first? So the state of mind was great. The circumstances were grim, and I was fine. Hawaii, circumstances were idyllic. The state of mind was grim, and I was really suffering. So it's a very simple example. Please think of your own. Jot some of them down over this weekend. Some retreats, I instruct people to not take notes or to write or anything because I really want you slow and deep in your direct experience. This retreat's also got an element of contemplation in it. So if it feels helpful to, you know, write a bit about times you've been really happy when the circumstances weren't easy, times you've been really miserable when the circumstances were easeful, just to make it more real for you. Apply this to your own life experience, right? So, when we grow up, how about we be happy and free from suffering first, and then work on the circumstances second? Everything from the house to the career to the dog to the car to everything else. And yet, that is easy to say, pretty easy to understand, and it's not easy to do, is it? Over and over again, we get caught up in, I need to make more money, or I'm frightened about this, or I won't be okay here. I do too. And there's so much anxiety and consternation when we're chasing after trying to find the perfect, the perfect formula to keep us safe and secure. That's the monkey. That monkey does not trust the future. That monkey does not trust that we'll be okay until we're not. That's when we draw our last breath. And after that, we're still probably okay. But for the purpose of tonight's talk, then you're dead. So until then, you're okay. Then I talked a little bit about emotions, a little bit. And I talked about how we tend to believe that things outside of us are what bring us happiness. I hope I've debunked that or at least shaken your belief in that so you'll look at it a bit harder. Okay, Cheryl, then what? If what you're saying, not me, people wiser than me, the Buddha and everybody since, say, it is the internal state of mind that determines your happiness or not. Well, then that would point toward what? How can I improve or make more flexible or make more strong my internal state of mind? How can I cultivate a happier mind, a more content mind? Well, that's what we're on about. That's what we're doing. So now I want to talk a little bit about so many things, but for tonight, back to where I began a little bit, was about emotion. And I said there isn't really a word for emotion in the Dharmic text, either Pali, the old spoken language, or in Sanskrit, the academic language, or even in Tibetan. What there are are a lot of words for states of mind that are unwholesome, right? So I made that beautiful distinction. We have bad and good in English and in the West, and there's just wholesome and unwholesome in what I consider to be a slightly wiser teaching in this way. And yet, okay, fine, I can go on and on about this, but let's cut to the chase. Does everybody here feel like they have emotions? I do. Are some of them really yucky? Yeah. If you're not putting your hand up, you're lazy or deaf. Of course we feel like we have emotions. And so arguably we do have emotions. But again, we identify them. I'm angry. This subtle shift. And I've seen this a little bit in my travels over the years in other cultures, cultures that have Buddhism as the base of the concept, the way allegedly in North America we more or less have Christianity or Judeo-Christianity as the base of our concepts, which includes you're born in original sin, and then you strive to be a good person, which is an awesome thing to be, and then you can go on to a better place. But in Buddha Dharma, there's a different point of view, which is you're born an elephant, so to speak. You're born a perfect Buddha. But then some junk gets in the way and some clouds cover the sun and some confusion happens and you may not feel as good. You may not act as skillfully. But by dissolving away, by practicing mindfully and with compassion and important traditions and important practices, you can begin to dissolve away the gunk layers you've kind of accumulated over your life so far and uncover what's already present. So instead of born in original sin and moving towards grace, which is one beautiful tradition, I'm not knocking it, but a different way of looking at it is you're born in grace and you get a bit confused and our work's to uncover the grace that's already present. So when I've been in cultures where that's the base assumption, if a kid says, I'm really angry, the parent might say, oh, so there's a state of anger present in the mind. I'm going to repeat that because it's actually really important and really helpful for each of us to practice. I'm angry. Oh, you mean there's a state of anger present in the mind? Feel that difference. It's not that I'm angry. There's a state of anger present in the mind. You could simplify that. Anger is present. Anger is present. Do you hear that? When you're separated from the anger that's present, and it's not, I'm angry, there's a bit more wiggle room. A bit more room to maybe look at the anger that's present. Here's a radical idea. Maybe bring some kindness to the anger that's present. Hey, anger, what's up? Can I help? When I'm angry, that's actually quite a sentence on oneself, isn't it? And then some of us go further. I'm just generally a depressed person. I'm generally an irritable person. What? Then the cat does something ridiculous and suddenly you're not irritable. So maybe you have a tendency towards some more grumpiness than the average. Maybe you're lighthearted. I'm a positive person. Then I suspect maybe you're more positive more of the time than your average bear, which is wonderful. But you're not that positive when you stub your toe or go bankrupt, probably. What would it be if from now on, from this night forward, we related to the states of mind as what they are, temporary states of mind? Oh, there's anger present. That's a temporary state of mind. And it's a yucky, painful one. And I'm feeling some suffering. Oh, wait, no, I'm not feeling suffering. Suffering is present in the mind. Okay. Compassion is arising. Compassion is sitting with the suffering in the mind. Compassion is sitting alongside the anger in the mind. This may sound like splitting hairs, but it's splitting hairs in the way that can reduce your suffering. Honest to goodness, if you walk out of here and from now on, when there's the feeling of anger or happiness, grief or horniness or whatever it is, you identify it as what it is, a fleeting state of mind. It might last a minute or less. It might last, it feels like, for an hour or two. Even there, if you're in meditation or paying close attention, if you're angry for an hour, you'll find that there's points in that hour where the anger dissolves for a minute or two and then is back, dissolves and then comes back. Why does that matter? It matters a lot because it helps you see the impermanence of this state. It's strong and then it mellows. It's strong and then it's mellows. It's strong and then it stops, then it roars back. So I'm painting all of this toward wanting to move us into looking at self-compassion over tomorrow and the next day. If there's anger present in the mind, am I a terrible person? No. If there's anger present in the mind and I act on that in a really unskillful way that really, really harms someone else, physically, mentally, or other, am I a terrible person? No. That was a really unwholesome act. That was a reaction to an unwholesome mind state, and it's not okay, and it doesn't mean you get off scot-free, but it also does not mean you're a terrible person. Even Hitler loved his dog. Even Hitler loved his dog. I think his dog's name was Goldie. So somewhere in that darkness and states of mind and delusion and greed and hatred was also some tenderness of heart. So emotions, I want you to start thinking about, we'll return to this over this retreat, emotions as states of mind, which is literally what they are. The way I like to teach that, drawing from Buddha Dharma and psychology and physiology, is I say an emotion is physiology plus story. So let's take anger. I'm angry. Well, there's a state of anger present, but we'll go with I'm angry. So when we're angry, when there's a state of anger present, the physiology changes, right? Let's say you're feeling quite enraged. So your heart rate will be accelerated. Your blood pressure will be up. There might be some sort of panting, some flushing of the face. There might be muscle tightening. Your guts might be kind of roiling. There are physiology going on, physical effects going on. And then the story is I'm angry, or maybe it's, you know, I hate that person, they're mean to me, or that shouldn't happen, that's super unfair, why is that person being so unfair to that other person? Self-righteous anger, and so on. But if we break down that emotional experience of I'm angry, that's what it is. There's physiology happening in the body, and there's a story. That's it. So we can change the story, and that might affect the physiology. We can change the physiology. That might help us rewrite a better story. Or we can see through all of it and go, there's a state of anger present. That's all that's happening. I don't have to act on it. I don't have to have a tantrum about it. I don't have to go on Facebook and write some vitriolic diatribe monkey nonsense to poison everybody else's day. I can go, oh, there's anger present. How can I be compassionate? How can I give this anger space? We'll work on this a bit this weekend. Substitute emotion there. Maybe anger's not a very common one for you. Maybe it's sadness or anxiety. Anxiety is a really good one to illustrate the physiology plus story. So imagine this. You're feeling jittery. Your heart's kind of pumping. There's a clamminess in your palms. And there's a state of like real hyper-focus to the mind and maybe a slight shortness of breath. Sounds like you're anxious, right? Well, it depends on the story. If the story is, oh no, something bad's about to happen, you're going to interpret and feel it as anxiety. If the story is, this is the most exciting day of my life, I'm about to receive the gold medal after winning the Olympics, then it's excitement. It's the same physiology with a different story, a different interpretation. You don't have to take my word for it. You can go look it up. Go do some research. But we act and feel, and I certainly do, experience as though those emotions are so freaking real. And often when we're in them, we also see them as completely reasonable. Sometimes we don't. We say, whoa, I really overacted. But other times it's really reasonable. This is anger. It's my anger. Darn it. I deserve it. And you deserve to hear all about it. Talk about suffering. And I doubt anybody in this room enjoys raging, enjoys panic attacks, enjoys grief. There can be a slight, not very wholesome enjoyment of anger and rage, sort of self-righteous getting it all off our chest. There are nuances. But even after that, probably you feel a bit drained and a bit ugh. So, I'm introducing a bunch of ideas here. I'm going to attempt to pick them up and weave with them through the weekend, or come back to them and bring them together around the larger teaching of how can we be compassionate to self. But I'm laying some groundwork tonight that it begins with starting to disidentify from that emotion and starting to see it for what it actually is. Also, according to modern neuroscience, which is a state in the mind that comes and goes. Modern neuroscience is dovetailing more and more with classic Buddha Dharma teaching. Let me repeat that. Seeing emotion for what it is, which is a temporary state in the mind, and it can affect the body and vice versa. It's a temporary state. So when one is feeling negative emotion, I suspect most of us, or all of us in this room, can be quite hard on ourselves about it. Like, oh, I got so angry and I lost my biscuit and I'm really embarrassed and that was stupid. Or why can't I stop this anxiety? What's wrong with me? I'm such a freak. Or, okay, I'm grieving, but it's been years and other people have gone through worse things. I'm just being so self-pitying. What's wrong with me? So this is sprinkling some seeds towards self-compassion, because if a dear friend, a friend that you just really have gentle, warm, sweet affection for, was he or her, they were saying to you, oh, I'm such an idiot, I got angry and I yelled at my neighbor and then I went and apologized, but I feel like such a loser and what's wrong with me? You'd probably be pretty kind to your friend. And you might say something like, well, you're human. We all blow it sometimes. I think it's great you went and apologized. That was big of you. Yeah, but yeah, I'm just, I don't think you should let yourself off the hook. That's why I think it's great you went and apologized. But you're not a terrible person. It was a state of anger. I still see your goodness. But when we do the same thing, it's like lash, 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 lash. So we're going to look at, I think I put it in the description, this description of this retreat, is can we come toward our own suffering the way we would a dear friend? The kindness we'd bring to a dear friend. And let me again repeat, though, it doesn't mean we'd let our friend off the hook and say, oh, that's fine. Everybody loses it sometime. I'm talking about really seeing them in their pain and saying, you're still a really decent human that made some bad choices there. But stop beating yourself out like the entirety of who you are is lousy, is bad, is broken. I'm worthless. I'm no good. I suspect a lot of you in your own ways, in your own particular types of self-torture, tell yourself, I'm not good enough. I'm unlovable. I've got such a terrible temper. I'm so lazy. And these absolute statements about yourself that if you said to your dear friend would make you a pretty rotten friend. So that's what we're going to start turning our mind toward tomorrow, is being compassionate for the states when they come and go, being compassionate to the one sort of person, the self having those states, experiencing those states, which leads to what? Well, ideally, it leads to being able to recognize those states more quickly, dissolve them more skillfully, have them melt away, and uncovering the happiness again. The clouds over the sun, the clouds of negative emotions, see them? Oh, these are clouds. Okay. The body's freaking out with adrenaline, cortisol, panic, and anxiety. I can't exactly fix that right away. It takes 20 or 30 minutes for the body to settle down after a flush of anxiety. But I'm aware this is temporary. I'm aware these are clouds. I'm aware this too shall pass. So I'm going to give myself a nice warm bath and read a sweet, heartwarming book. While I wait for the body to calm down, I'm going to treat this state of panic with kindness instead of, oh, I'm such an idiot. I can't shake this anxiety. What's wrong with me? And all this super mean stuff we do to ourselves. An analogy that might be helpful, I know there's lots of animal lovers in the room. If you adopt a rescue, we've got a rescue dog and three rescue cats of various ilks. When you adopt a rescue animal, sometimes they haven't had a very nice beginning, depending, and they might have fear. They might have some trigger issues, right? Maybe they had a pretty unhappy first 6 months and then they were blessed enough to come into your care. And if you reach out to Pat, your friendly pet, who's normally quite friendly, and they attack you, they bite you, or they scratch you, they create harm on your hand, you're going to beat the dog in this scenario? No, you're not. Or the cat. You're going to understand that, wow, that cat or dog is either frightened or in physical pain. That's why they lashed out. They're not actually angry. Arguably, animals are never angry. You can go think about that one. They're in fear or pain, or they need to mate, or they need to eat, or etc. It's not like anger for no reason. So the point is, if you reach out to your generally mild-mannered critter and it savages you in some way, your best response, and probably your heart's response in this scenario, if you're an animal lover and you understand that's not typical behavior, is what's wrong, right? Maybe when you look more closely, your pet has a broken foot, and when you reached out, it really hurt their foot and they snapped at you. Or maybe you see they're cowering in fear because someone other than you, when they reached toward them, that hand had a different meaning. And your heart would melt. I mean, you still need to tend to your scratches or bites, for sure. But I doubt you'd hold it bitterly against. That was a temporary state of fear or hurt that being lashed out. Well, that's like us. When we lash out, it's a temporary state of fear or hurt or anger. Anger is a secondary emotion. I'm offering a lot right now. I'll dial it back. But what I mean by that is, in general, this is a useful way to look at anger, that anger is often a secondary emotion, and under it is either pain or fear, or both. Emotional pain and hurt, physical pain as well, or fear or both. And anger is the cover story. I work with a lot of couples. It's primarily what I do in my professional world these days. And when couples are angry at each other, when I'm able to work with them in certain ways, I can help them get under that anger. And often they'll start to cry, or they'll turn to their partner and say, "Can you hold me?" Or the fear, the panic will come out that the anger was covering. Temporary states. Temporary states. But, and I'll draw this to a close in a bit because I'm offering a lot of different pieces, but I'll do my best to return to them and weave them together over the weekend. You're an awake Buddha underneath those temporary states. You're an elephant underneath a whole troop of screaming baboon monkeys and everything else. There's just an awakened elephant, an awakened shining sun, an awakened Buddha, and these temporary clouds, these temporary states, these temporary monkey attacks come and go, and when they dissolve away because they're temporary, what's left? The original state. The original state of happiness, curiosity, contentment, and awakening. Which is why, when I was seeing if Amy and Rachel would run screaming from the retreat, I talked about my first weekend retreat being awful. Like, there was so much suffering in the mind, so much anxiety, panic, despair, frustration, itsiness. I couldn't focus on one breath for the whole breath, much less several in a row or anything. It was just a battle. But then there are these moments, right? Those few moments where it was easy and full and gentle. So in the ways I'm bringing the teachings forward tonight, that's where all the temporary states settled for a minute or two, and what was underneath was just happy and pleasant and calm. Like the whole 30 minutes were for this mind tonight in that sit. That's not every sit I have is easy and graceful and open, but most of them are. Only took 23 years. Don't give up. When meditating, the mind is often easy and graceful. I am nowhere near yet where the mind is always easy and graceful in day-to-day life. There are temporary states that feel like they last a long time. And a lot of them are not very fun. Some of them are. So I chose very deliberately not to teach on self-compassion tonight, because I wanted to start drawing our attention to what emotions are and are not, how to begin to think about them differently for some of us, how to, in a way, separate the being, non-being we are from the temporary states, and then sprinkle in these contemplations for you. Are there times in your life, I know there are, big or small, where everything or a lot of things were really positive around you and you were really struggling or suffering, or where things were really rough around you and you were doing well, really driving home that, oh yeah, Hawaii doesn't make me happy. Oh yeah, really disgusting hovels don't make me miserable. This does. And then sprinkling in those thoughts that we'll be developing, watering and nurturing this weekend around, how can I be kinder to my so-called self? How can I have more patience with these temporary states that come and go? How can I nurture my own good heart more deeply and more well? So, as an introduction to our weekend together, I hope that was helpful and gave you a few things to think about. I think I have a couple lovely quotes here I will share with you on a couple of these themes. Bear with me a moment. Oh yeah, this one's from the poet, the writer, W.H. Auden. It's a very simple quote. Love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart. And your crooked neighbor is also you. So can you love your own crooked self? I'm extemporizing from his quote now. Can you love your own crooked self with all your crooked heart? And His Holiness the Dalai Lama, this one bears repeating. I repeat it often, right, gang? Be kind whenever possible, .. It's always possible. It's so true. It's so easy to forget. So easy to forget.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Sex, Love, and Elephants. But most of all, thank you for being part of this herd. If you enjoyed listening, please share this with a friend. And if you haven't already, I would love, love, love it if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show on your podcast player, because it really helps all the other elephants find us. If you have any questions or comments or maybe an idea for the show or you'd like to be a guest, reach out to me directly at drcherylfraser.com, where you can also sign up for weekly Love Bites, science-based tips for creating love and passion that last a lifetime.